Welcome to All Analytics Conversations. This is Jim Connolly, editor of allanalytics.com. Today we're looking at some of the emerging technologies that have been enabled by data analytics. One aspect we want to cover in this blogger roundtable version of A2 Conversations is how those data-driven technologies also gather up new data and how new data can enable still more future technologies and applications. I like to call it a continuous cycle of data analytics. Now, consider these data-driven technologies like autonomous cars, the Internet of Things, and the combination of artificial intelligence with robots. In each case, those technologies will become better and may spawn new uses for tech based on real-world data. With me today are two of our regular bloggers on All Analytics, our community editor, Dave Wagner, and Lyndon Henry, who is our go-to blogger when it comes to things like the use of analytics in transportation. Dave, Lyndon, how are you today?
Good. Thanks for having me, Jim.
Yeah, thanks. I'm glad to be here.
All right. Dave's been on A2 Radio a number of times over the past couple of years, but Lyndon, this is your first appearance. Could you tell the audience a little bit about your background and what you do for a living?
I've been a transportation planning consultant, half a century. And in addition to that, I do a lot of writing, journalism. I do a writing and editing service and a lot of different things. But the hat I mostly wear is transportation planning and, work in public transportation. So that's
great.
Been my main involvement with analytics.
Oh, that's great. It'll fit in with what we're talking about today. Now, for the audience, before we get into the discussion, let me add one note. We welcome your questions and comments on the chat board below, and we'll address as many as we can during the next half hour. To get the discussion started, I invite listeners to introduce themselves to their peers on the chat board and perhaps share your own observations about how data is changing your lives for the better or for the worse. Now, let's talk about analytics and new technologies. We'll start with self-driving vehicles. Dave, I know you're a fan of the concept of autonomous cars. What have you seen happening lately, and what kind of time frame do you see for adoption by the average person?
Right. Well, I think, funny enough, the biggest news over the last couple of weeks with autonomous cars is that one got into an accident. And I say that not to disparage them. I actually think this is good news. I think, first of all, we need to get the kinks out of these systems, and there are going to be accidents along the way. I also think that the fact that it gets into an accident more so in autonomous vehicles and other artificial intelligence than in any other situation, accidents are where we're going to learn. Right. It is really easy to put a car inside a controlled environment and ask it to go through a controlled course. The harder step is asking an autonomous vehicle to handle other humans and other autonomous vehicles in an open road situation. So minor accidents like this one, and it was a very low speed accident, are something that we need to have happen. And obviously, I don't want anybody hurt, and nobody was, thankfully. So the biggest news might be simply that we're starting to finally risk this enough that we're going to start learning real world stuff. And as for when the regular person is going to be involved, I used to say, even just a year or two ago, that I believed in Google's number of 2020. A lot of other car makers have said 2020 is a good year. I think 2020 is going to be the year that we see a product released. I don't think it's actually going to be cheap enough for everyday use for probably another 5 to 10 years after that.
Let me say a couple of things, and I agree with Dave that accidents are certainly going to teach the industry a lot of things and give that important feedback to tweak these new systems. One thing that occurred to me out of this Google car accident was that it kind of emphasizes a point I made in one of my blogs, one of my blog posts, that there's going to be a huge demand within the analytics profession for people to do coding of the urban street network. Essentially what happened in that accident was something that was not on any maps, not on any of the pre-programmed inform data available to the computer in the car, but it was essential. I think it was something like an obstacle, like a sack of cement or something like that was on the roadway. The car made a swerve to avoid that. It was unplanned. It suddenly encountered this, and it sideswiped a bus. It was going at very low speed, so that's probably why there was no injuries, but the car was banged up and so forth. And what that indicates is that there is when you get into an urban environment, there's a lot of different stuff going on in the street. It's not like a freeway. A freeway, you can use the striping, you can use the infrastructure on each side, barriers and so forth, and those pretty much stay the same. But it's these things that happen on urban streets that are going to be a real challenge to the system. And I see that the implication of that, if the transportation industry is serious about getting more into that, that's going to mean a huge demand for people to do all the coding of that, mapping those street networks, which has not been done so far.
Well, it's interesting because what you're talking about is true. Mapping of the street networks absolutely vital, particularly since they change. But the fascinating part about this is that this is not something that's ever going to appear on Google Maps, right? This is the equivalent of what a human goes through when they're driving down the highway at 65 miles an hour and something falls off the truck in front of them,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so when you're absolutely right about the network, we also are going to have to deal with sensors that respond to objects quickly. And most importantly, we have an interesting issue with ethical programming there, right? Because in the future, one of the things that's absolutely going to be programmed into Google after this, I'm sure, into Google Car, is if you have a choice between hitting a bus or a bag of cement, hit the bag of cement, right? Right?
Yeah.
Don't hit the bus, right? And now, of course, there's this long-held ethical issue, is what happens when you have a choice between hitting the child that runs into the road or the school bus full of children, right? So one of the things we're going to have to figure out is when a car is being asked to make an impossible choice, how are you going to get it to make that impossible choice? And what I thought was very interesting is I had a conversation recently with some robotics experts at Georgia Tech, and they gave me a really good answer to this, and it's the first time I've ever heard somebody say that, to give me this answer. And they said, we don't expect humans to always make that decision correctly. There's so much context around it. Why should we expect our computers to be superhuman and make better decisions? And so one of the things that's fascinating about that is that we're going to have to change, in my mind, the perception that the Google car is going to be perfect.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a good point. Let me just say that we had a very good blog post on this. I think it was by Ariella Brown, who brought up this whole issue of the ethical implications. I think it was she who made that that blog post. At any rate, we had a very good discussion on that, and exactly what Dave was just talking about, which is making those ethical decisions. The other thing that came to mind about this was that as the Google car was avoiding the whatever was in the roadway, you know, this unexpected object, it somehow or other expected the bus to watch out for it. I did not expect the bus to continue to do what it did and result in the sideswiping incident, which brings up the other thing, another major issue in all of this, which is the unexpected behavior of all the other drivers on the road. And as we get more and more into introducing some kind of automated functioning, I think there's going to be a lot of these kinds of things arising of what happens. And, one of the issues that we've talked about on All Analytics and other discussions regarding autonomous cars, driverless cars, has been the reaction of other drivers, the ones that are tailgating. In a lot of the accidents that have happened with Google cars before, some of them have involved, for example, being tail-ended and rear-ended by a following car driven by a human. But that's what humans do. They expect certain things to happen. They don't expect the car in front of them to stop on a dime or something like that. So there are, in other words, what has to happen is somehow or other, the algorithms have to be adjusted to account for the natural behavior of humans around them. So that'll be an interesting development.
Right. Well, the most fascinating thing right now is that one autonomous car is more dangerous than a highway full of them. Because a highway full of them, they can communicate with each other. They will behave as they would expect each other to behave.
Exactly.
But one behaves entirely differently than a human. So we have to rethink as autonomous vehicles grow in use, we will have to rethink the way they're programmed all over again to respond to a more autonomous highway.
Yeah, and this is where
B2B
comes in, this vehicle-to-vehicle technology.
Right.
Right, and you're also going to have to deal with the installed base issue, which we're familiar with in computing, and that is that everybody already has a car that they operate themselves. So at what point do you start turning over that inventory, which, could be, presumably, well down the road. But let me drag us back to the issue that we were talking about earlier, and that is, while data allows autonomous cars, what kind of data will be taken out of that car in terms of your behavior, what's going on the roads around you, where you go, anything like that, whether it's that information is going to Google or to the highway department or to somebody that is buying data from Google.
And your insurance company.
Yeah. Well, they're already working on that one.
And the police and the government.
Yeah. Right.
What's fascinating about that question is that question for autonomous vehicles may or may not be as frightening as it will be for our later topic, which is the IoT, because I am already driving with my phone that essentially tells the world where I am every second of the day anyway. But it's clear to me with that bounce. That's one of the reasons why Google wants to do this, right? I mean, and other companies, right? But Google specifically, because the other car industries are obviously just competing in the car industry. But Google's existence is around our data, right? It's around advertising. It's around search, right? So it would make absolute sense that driving is a place of data that they are not already involved. They have my phone data because I'm an Android user. They have my search data. They even have a certain amount of shopping data. This is a new frontier for them to a certain degree, and that's why it makes so much sense for Google to want to be involved. And it does create a whole new business plan around offering me coupons to eat at a certain restaurant while I'm driving by, offering me sales on products as I go by, to even send my autonomous vehicle out to get its oil changed at a certain place. All of that is there, and it's going to be used, and the data is going to be real. Fascinatingly enough, though, I think that can be accomplished without autonomous vehicles through the phone. So it may not be as sort of magical or transformative as it will be when we talk about the IoT later.
Before we move deeper into the IoT, let me just throw out one more quick question. And if you guys have a real quick way to answer it, that would be great. Question from the audience is, if the computer in the car is not more perfect than humans, then why do it?
Well, first of all, if it were not more perfect than humans, then they probably wouldn't do it. But the basic answer to that is that these are can be considerably safer in a number of respects. Not necessarily all respects, but I would say in a lot of important respects. So that's one of the major issues with it. A lot of people are looking at these things for incredible convenience. As you probably know, I'm skeptical about that. I don't necessarily see them, you know, summoning up our autonomous car from the garage or something like you know, Roy Rogers used to whistle for Trigger or something. But I think there will be a lot of innovation that benefits us. A lot of that's starting to appear already. As a matter of fact, you could say that cruise control is an early step toward, you know, autonomous driving. But to have, you know, the steering and everything ultimately control will be beneficial because it can react faster and so forth. So I don't think it's not it's more. I would say it is more nearly perfect than you. It's not perfect, but it is probably closer to perfection than
right. It's absolutely going to be safer. It's just not going to be perfectly safe. We should never expect it to be so. The other answer to that is that I believe last year a report came out that said that we are short 50,000 long-haul truckers in this country. And so one answer to this question is that Google, Uber, FedEx, UPS, all of these companies aren't even in this for the autonomous passenger vehicle as much as they are for transportation and long-haul trucking, which is a hundreds of billions, if not trillions of dollar business. I'd have to look it up exactly globally, but I'm pretty sure it's over $1 trillion in global shipping through trucks. So it may not even have anything to do in the end with cars as much as it has to do with shipping.
So
So that industry is facing the same problem as the analytics sector, which is the talent shortage.
Right. Yep. And not only a talent shortage in the sense of not enough good drivers, but simply an inability to pay. Like, it's a supply and demand issue in this case, right? You have to deliver the goods below a certain price so that the price of the goods are not affected. And in that case, long-haul truckers are making less per hour when adjusted for inflation than they were, say, 20 to 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's look at the IoT. And I'm not just talking about the consumer-facing IoT, but just how it's being used even today. And, I can easily imagine how IoT can create this continuous cycle of innovation based on the data being generated by sensors. If you take the case of the manufacturing line, sensors collect data not only on the performance of the machines, but it helps managers to maintain their equipment and provides detailed feedback to the equipment makers themselves that they can then use in turn to design future generations of machines. Plus, now, the data that's collected by the IoT about the supply chain and about your business processes and workflows can now allow you to tweak those processes. How do you guys see the data, the IoT data, coming back to create new offerings, new applications, new products?
Well, how the data would come back to do that, I can't immediately answer that, except that what I can say is that I think that as people in various industries start using IoT for different things, they will figure out more and more ways that it might be useful. That will feed back to the developers, and I think that'll be the process that you'll mostly see. To say, hey, I'm using IoT for this. Why couldn't I use it for this over here? You know, oh, okay. Well, we'll come up with some. We'll come up with an app to do that. I might add that I tend to see, especially in industry, that IoT is going to be used more for a kind of a one-directional thing. The information to the manager, information to the operator. And rather than the operator using that to somehow or other control the machines and so forth. And the reason for that is, my speculation is that it will go that way because they're afraid of the security aspects. If they start, this is something that's out on the Internet, and no matter how much security there might be behind it, they would be fearful that, their power generator will be shut off, or something else, some other major. You're talking about some pretty big machines here, and that would be liable to somebody essentially being hijacked. So I don't know if you want to bat that around a little bit, but anyway, that's just my speculation. It'll be used more for information and monitoring of machine processes and so forth.
So a manager might get an alert and then send a real human out to take action.
That would be the idea, and
right.
used some kind of closed system to actually do the controlling. But incidentally, my very first experience with this, at least in my profession, was with Amtrak in a meeting. Just I want to say it was about 3 or 4 years ago. One of the managers, kind of a mid-level manager at that meeting, was involved with rolling stock maintenance, both locomotives and the passenger cars. And he took me aside and showed me on his smartphone that he could monitor even while the rolling stock was in operation. In other words, a passenger train going across the country, he could get information coming from that as to how it was performing, how the air conditioning system was, if the wheels were working properly, basically, the toilets were working. Had the locomotive was the engine in the locomotive working okay? All kinds of information like that. He could just call it up. So that was a very interesting app, and that gave me the idea that this is a very useful system for monitoring these. You could go in a whole bunch of different industries with that. And
right.
Of course, since then, over the three or four years, IoT has just exploded in many different ways.
To take Lyndon's story one step farther and to prove your point, Jim, GE told a story at this year's Gartner CIO Symposium about how they had installed sensors in their jet engines to help learn about fuel efficiency. In the process, they discovered that a certain percentage of their engines were needing maintenance faster than they were recommending and expecting, and that others of those engines didn't need it as often. And what they were able to do is eventually determine that the engines that needed the repair more often were flying in environments that were more hostile to the engine than the others. And they were able to see this in real time, what the engines were going through and how they were deteriorating, so that they could recommend to airlines different maintenance schedules that allowed them to use analytics to save money on when to pull an engine off the line, which I think is exactly the kind of lessons we're going to see through IoT in the next few years, where we're going to install sensors for one thing, and we're going to discover other lessons from those sensors that we then can can use. And a learning organization, one that knows how to identify the information and lessons from analytics that weren't even designed for that purpose, are the ones that are going to really succeed.
Right. In that case, you're changing a process
exactly.
based on
yep.
your feedback from the field.
Right. And feedback that was different than expected, too.
How comfortable are you guys in terms of the IoT on the retail side or in terms of service providers and the like of, you know, you walk into a store now and if you have their loyalty app, you know, and you turn it on, they, you know, their beacons can track you and know what you're doing, what you've done before in terms of, say, browsing on the web. Are we reaching a point where some of that is going to go a little bit over the edge?
You know what? I would have answered this question entirely differently about 3 months ago. In the last couple of months, I have had conversations with CIOs where the conversation has changed entirely from what I was hearing 3 months ago. I had a conversation just yesterday with a Fortune 500 CIO that I don't believe I can quote directly on the air because we didn't talk about whether I would be doing that. But he said to me that they are just fine doing digital advertising where they're getting significant more returns on investment for their advertising than they were with traditional advertising channels without knowing intimate customer details. And the way they're doing that is just by aggregating. They're getting information that people are already willing to give through Google search, through those sorts of ways that anonymize them, and they're doing just fine. And more, when I'm talking to CIOs, I'm hearing that they're getting pushback from consumers saying, we don't want you to know this much. And CIOs are saying, okay, that's fine. We know where the limit is. We'll work within that limit, and we can do well within that limit, which surprised me because I honestly didn't think we'd be there 3 months ago, that CIOs were starting to draw a line, CMOs are starting to draw a line. I think consumers actually succeeded for a change at showing where the line was.
So they're finding a balance. A balance point.
Yeah, you know, a balance where they're serving the customer, right? The customer, what I keep hearing is that consumers are happy if you can give them a compelling reason why this matters. So they'll give you this information if they get a compelling service back, or they're happy with a certain level of intrusion because you're giving them useful information, useful services, discounts, and they want, and they're happy to do it with a transparency around it, and they'll draw a line, and CIOs are willing to say, okay, this is too far. People are saying, no, I don't want to do that, and they're willing to work with that, and 3 months ago, honestly, I thought we were just going to keep intruding on people forever, but CIOs are telling me now directly, we can do without this stuff. And there's a security element to it, right? The CIO I talked to yesterday said one of the reasons why he doesn't want more intimate customer information is because then he is responsible for securing it. And he knows that he can't do that because we're in a world where breaches happen, that there's no such thing anymore as a secure organization. So he is just as interested in not holding that information as he is in
yep.
you know, what he can do with the information he has.
Hey, guys, we're actually running down to the last couple minutes here. We carry this on all afternoon, I think. The final thing I wanted to raise and just get your thoughts is robots and artificial intelligence have generated a lot of interest in the A2 community lately, particularly with, you know, more thought leaders like Bill Gates and Stephen Hawking voicing concerns over the use of AI in areas like warfare where machines present new threats to humans. But we've also been talking a lot about the role of computers and robots in the workforce and whether they force us out of jobs. Do you guys have any real concerns about either of those scenarios?
Well, as I've indicated by some postings recently on some comments on some of the discussion, I don't think it's as dire a threat as a lot of people are portraying it. But I think there are concerns. I don't see a future where suddenly the machines are going to replace humans, mainly for economic reasons, because you start eliminating humans, workers, you're eliminating the money to buy the products of the machines and so forth. You see where I'm going with that. And at the same time, what I see is kind of a lot of dislocations and so forth happening. So I guess it's going to be kind of a mixed result with a lot of people in hardship and so forth because of this, some people benefiting. That's the kind of future that I'm looking at with this.
Yeah, I guess I'm a little more pessimistic in the short-term transition because I think that robots, artificial intelligence, smart algorithms are an absolute necessity at this point to do business. It is simply impossible at this point with the IoT, if I have a million sensors coming in to give me a million points of data, it is impossible to employ enough humans to respond to that data in a useful way. So if you go back to Lyndon's example about the train, looking at one engine on an app is useful. Looking at 100 engines on an app gets harder and harder. It's eventually going to become where that human can't respond to the broken toilet or the broken train track or the whatever fast enough. So he needs to set up automated systems to respond to those sorts of crises. And as that happens more and more, as business speeds up and we're replacing people with algorithms, I'm a little worried about what the transition is. I'm perfectly happy for robots to replace menial labor. I think humans deserve the dignity of not having to do that. What I'm worried about is doing so eventually leads to a situation where we have more people than need of people. In an agrarian society, you need an awful lot of children just to plant the corn and harvest it, all of that. And as things change and the number of people you need shrinks to run an economy, a world economy, there's a fight for resources that frightens me. So I tell my children, you better do something that has something to do with robots, because eventually the only two jobs left in the world are going to be robot designer and robot repairman, and eventually the robots will learn to do those two things too.
Yep. You know, one of our other bloggers, Dan Gutierrez, made a good point. He posted a blog about the Gates and Hawking other tech leaders with their comments, and he pointed out that AI, we make it sound like AI is easy to do, but the amount of programming that goes into even a simple task makes it very difficult for a computer to learn more than what you program it for. But I guess, you know, the other concern that would come up is what about evildoers, and what would they do with AI, whether they're thieves or they're terrorists or what have you. So that, you know, they aren't working with the same strictures that the rest of us are. Anyway, any final thoughts on that one, you guys? We're actually past our normal cutoff out time here. Lyndon?
I think you've got a point there. I mean, something like this can be used, nefariously. I would say the evildoers, it depends on your perspective. I mean, if you're in the United States, the United States seems to be the good guy, and if you're in Russia, that's the evildoer. But the thing is reversed. If you're in Russia, it's exactly the opposite. And So there will be some things that are unsavory. We've talked about those too. I would say the main impact is going to be on the employment market and things that are going to happen in terms of jobs, especially the lower end jobs. And a lot of people are dependent on those lower end jobs. You're talking about retail clerks. You're talking about truck drivers. You're talking about the garbage collectors and a lot of people that made up got themselves through college or whatever on low end jobs like that are going to be are going to go the way of automation. So,
David Linden, this has been great. Sorry,
can Dave, can I get a quick answer? Can I get a quick
sure.
answer to that?
Yep.
Because I talked to some roboticists at Georgia Tech this week that I thought made a really interesting point, which is they said the perception that robots can be evil comes with the fact that they respond to language differently, and so we think of them as psychopaths. So their example was, if you tell an AI right now, let's say you're sick and you need the robot to get your medicine. If you say, please go to the pharmacy and get my medicine as quickly as possible, what the robot will do is skip the line at the pharmacy, go in, grab the medicine, and leave without paying for it because that's the quickest way possible, right? In humans have instead, however, set up a situation where we believe in certain social norms, like you wait your turn at the pharmacy, you pay for your medicine. So he said that one of the things that has to be done is teaching robots, and they're working on that right now, teaching robots to listen to how a story is told to them about how a person would do this. So you would say, well, if I went to the drugstore, I would go to the drugstore, I would wait in line, et cetera, et cetera. And there are two advantages to that. And the first is the robot will stop behaving like a psychopath. The second advantage is you can actually program a robot to do something outside of a laboratory setting, outside of an expensive development setting. And that creates a situation where robots are finally democratized so that regular people can use robots. When regular people can use and program robots, they become safer, actually, because they take on our traits rather than the trait of the evil genius who's programming it alone in a laboratory. So, that's just my answer about that.
Given the way pharmacy copays sometimes run, I think I want that robot.
Right.
guys, this has been great. We're gonna turn to the text chat on All Analytics in a second. I want to thank our guests today, A2 Community Editor Dave Wagner and blogger Lyndon Henry, for being with us today and sharing their thoughts as we peer into the future and a little bit into the present. And thanks to our sponsor, SAS, and to all of you for being with us today. This has been Jim Connolly for All Analytics Conversations and UBM Tech. Thank you for tuning in, everyone, and have a great day.
Yeah, thank you, Jim.